can see on either side of me, I've got some very large backstop. We're here to consider submissions received on the Prevention and Combating of Torture of Persons Bill. And we'll spend the whole day doing that. We want to express our appreciation right at the offset to all those organizations and persons who took the trouble to make written submissions. You have a program in front of you, at least you should have, and that is the program we'll follow. We trust that all the organizations who are on the program are present, so that in the event that, unlikely event, that we finish earlier, the next in line can take their place. All right. The first on the agenda is for us to hear the South African Catholic Bishops Conference, who are represented by Advocate Mike Pottier. I'm not sure if there's anybody else, Mike, or it's just you.
There are a few people behind me. I'll introduce them when I start.
Good. Please.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Good morning to all members, and if I may, good morning to all my colleagues from Civil Society. I have with me and behind me in the corner our Director, Father Peter John Pearson, two interns who are with us for 6 months from the University of Notre Dame in the United States, Awatu Hamoudi and Julie Bodnar. And for the first time in the 15 years or so that I've been coming to Parliament to make submissions, also my wife is here to see how I perform on these occasions. So if I'm a little bit more nervous than usual, that's why. It's good again to see a full room, if I may just remark on the what an endorsement this is of the openness of Parliament and of the committee system. As we come back once again to address you from the perspective of a civil society organization, it's good to see that you have a day-long list of submissions on a very important piece of legislation. I think ours is about the shortest and the most brief submission. I'm just going to run quickly through the particular comments that we have, starting with the question of the definition of torture and the fact that for some reason which is not clear to us, it has been decided to separate that part of the definition that deals with the perpetrator. So whereas the UN Convention talks about pain and suffering inflicted by or at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in an official capacity, instead this bill accommodates people acting with the consent or acquiescence, i.e. people are not by definition public officials themselves, or not obviously public officials themselves. It accommodates them by referring to them in the definitions clause, and in effect it deems such people to be public officials. Perhaps the drafters will be able to say why they decided to do that, but it doesn't appear to make any obvious sense to do that. And in a way then it ends up stretching this definition of public official well beyond where it should go. So the examples that we've given, if you have a situation where a prison warder, who clearly is a public official, should happen to turn a blind eye to the kind of torture that we know happens amongst the gangs in prison, turns a blind eye, in other words acquiesces, then suddenly those gang members become or are deemed to be public officials, which strikes one as a bit absurd. We've also given the example here of in the previous time in our country where Hurtuga and Askari and all sorts of other people were operating with the acquiescence and sometimes with the consent and sometimes at quite a distance from under the direction, third or fourth hand, of public officials such as the police. They would also, in terms of the definition, then become public officials themselves. As I say, there may be a good reason for this, but it's not apparent what it is. So we would, with respect, suggest that the committee needs to inquire into that aspect. And if there isn't any particular reason, then it would seem sensible simply to adopt the convention's definition verbatim into our legislation. Second point that we want to make relates to the proviso in clause 3. And this in a way creates an exception in that any pain or suffering which arises from, is inherent in, or incidental to lawful sanctions would be excluded from the definition of torture. Now clearly, when you have a lawful sanction, particularly if it's imprisonment, there's going to be a measure of pain and suffering, mental, psychological anguish, etc. That's unavoidable. But we feel that the phrasing of something which is merely incidental to the main sanction is a little bit too wide-ranging and makes it, in a sense, too easy to excuse what could in fact be very severe pain and suffering. And the key consideration we suggest must be that this pain and suffering should be what is limited to what is an unavoidable consequence of lawful sanctions. So on the one hand, we cannot ever envisage a situation where the imposition of imprisonment is going to be entirely free of mental and psychological anguish. That would be an unreasonable standard to set. But at the same time, one is a bit concerned that it would be too easy to excuse or to overlook the infliction of further pain and suffering on the basis that, well, you know, this is inevitable, this just has to happen as part and parcel of sanctions such as imprisonment. So we suggest that bringing in the concept of unavoidability, or perhaps reasonably unavoidable, into that proviso would solve the problem to a very large extent. We move on to point 2.3 of our submission, dealing with offences and penalties, clause 4 of the bill. We want to support very strongly clause 4.3.a. This is one that deals with, in essence, people who should not be excused the consequences of committing torture simply by virtue of their public offices. So it tells us that the fact that a person is or was a head of state or of government or a member of government or parliament or an elected representative or a government official cannot be taken into account as a defense to a charge of committing torture or for purposes of reduction of sentence. That's very, very important. Obviously, we know only too well how many presidents and other heads of state, senior government officials, in fact, instigate torture or, once again, acquiesce. And they know very well what is happening, they take no steps to prevent it. It suits their purposes. So the fact that they stand to be punished is of the greatest importance. However, almost in contrast to that, clause 4.3b, we suggest, needs to be looked at, because it ultimately equates the guilt of the most menial foot soldier to that of the person in charge of the whole process. It says that the fact that a person was under a legal obligation to obey a manifestly unlawful order of a government or superior is no excuse. It's our submission that the moral blameworthiness of the president, the minister, the general, who orders an act of torture, is of a much higher level than that of the person who may be forced into carrying it out, particularly when the person is faced with almost no choice. And I think we have to avoid here what the court's terms of armchair decisions made here in the comfort of an armchair about what might be happening out there in that real and horrible world of conflict, of war, of riot control, etc., etc. You can easily envisage a very young soldier, police officer, 18, 19 years old, in the heat of some sort of situation, being told to do something. It may or may not strike that person that it's right or wrong. They simply don't have the opportunity to decide for themselves whether this is a manifestly unjust order. And they've got someone screaming an order at them, maybe at the end of a gun. And then when everything has calmed down after, they find themselves charged with having committed an act of torture. And they find that according to this bill, that whole complex circumstance under which they acted cannot be taken into account for purposes of punishment. I would suggest that comes very close to a situation of unfairness in a constitutional sense. Our courts have always taken account of moral blameworthiness when it comes to the imposition of sentence, and this seeks to remove that possibility when it comes to the imposition of sentence. I suggest that needs to be very carefully looked at. Clause 4.4, again, we support the clause. We just think that we should perhaps add the notion of national security as one of those factors which may not be invoked as a justification for torture. The mantra of national security is something that we've all become very, very familiar with of late, internationally and also in this country, and it seems that there's no reason not to include it there. We're going to include things like threat of war and internal political instability. I know it says any other public emergency, but national security is not always a question of emergency. It might be a much more sort of deeply underlying, everyday kind of consideration. The fact is, it is used all over the world to excuse all sorts of egregious violations of human rights, and perhaps it needs to be expressly mentioned in this bill. Moving on to Clause 8, speaks about a general responsibility to promote awareness. In a sense, this is one of the most important aspects, because one feels that perhaps a huge number of public officials, and particularly those who are working broadly in the area of law and order, have very little understanding at the moment of what might constitute torture. And once this bill becomes law, even though they will be bound by it, most of them are not going to sort of innately or inherently understand that that little step out of line in an interrogation, that little, and I use the word advisor, I'm not being flippant about it, but that little assault that happens in the prison when the prisoner is being unruly or refusing to obey a command or something like that, that those everyday things, which to the people concerned are almost mundane, that they constitute torture, according to the definitions here. So there's going to have to be a huge effort on the part of the authorities to promote this kind of awareness, a huge effort of training and conscientizing. And with due respect to the various ministries and departments involved, we cannot simply take it for granted that this is going to happen. I think that this is an area par excellence for strong parliamentary oversight by this committee and the other committees involved, such as correctional services, to make sure that Clause 8 is actually put into practice and that the relevant ministers do what they really need to do by way of regulation and training and finally implementation. Yeah. Chairperson, I think that's the gist of our comments. I'm very happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Advocate Bhatia. All right. Let's keep a careful check. Let me see. Raise your hands again, please. Prof. J.J. Smuts, Mr. Schaefer. In that order, please.
Thank you very much, Chair. Could I obtain clarity from the South African Catholic Bishops Conference to make a distinction between the offender and the victim in your definition of torture? Could you please clarify that?
Will you take, before you respond, Mike, let's hear all of them, all right? Mm-hmm. So you'll just object.
It's more, I mean, obviously we'll look at the points you're making, just it's an observation that on the one hand, in Clause 3, which effectively is a definition of torture, you want us to follow the convention. But then when it comes to the issue of your second submission around the pain and suffering, you don't want us to follow the convention. You want us to improve on the convention, you want unavoidable consequences, and similarly with the issue of national security being included as a under 4.4,
You don't want us to follow the convention. You want us to approve on the convention because national security is not in the convention. So it's just pointing out that that irony, I suppose you could say. But otherwise, I think from my side, yeah, we'll look at the submissions.
Mine was exactly the same point, but let me phrase it simply in this way. Why should the insertion of the word only in the proviso in 3 not be good enough? What do you think we've achieved if you add to that the unavoidability of the consequences? You're expanding the definition, of course you are, but address us on that. Why is the insertion of the word only, which is in the convention but not in a, in the proviso, not enough?
I just want to ask about your, other submissions seem to be doing exactly the opposite of what you're doing. They're saying that we should make sure that it doesn't confine itself only to public officials. And I'm quite interested to know why you, what about a situation where people in prison are getting raped daily with or without the knowledge of public officials? Surely it could sometimes be classified as torture. And why should they then exclude it from that? And also your, thinks about moral blameworthiness for officials. I mean, I'm not an expert on these matters in practice, but surely torture doesn't generally happen in the heat of the moment. It's something that's prolonged and it happens generally over a period of time. It's not something like a reaction to a specific situation. So I'm quite intrigued by your submission that we should use it as a moral blameworthiness issue.
I'm afraid I didn't quite follow the first question, the distinction between victim and offender in the definitions. Perhaps if I could just have the clarity on that question.
Maybe what I'm trying to say, when we talk about crime, we distinguish between the criminal and the victim. Now, my general question is, do you think in defining torture, should we specifically define torture separately for the offender and separately for the victim of the offence? I hope it's clear enough.
I doubt whether there's any particular need to do that, because the definition of the act that constitutes torture is in itself, I think, as wide as it needs to be. It's an act which is carried out in order to obtain information or confession, to punish person for something that they have committed or suspected of having committed, etc., etc. In a sense, who the victim is immaterial to the definition. What we're trying to control is the act carried out. That's my sense. So I don't think that one needs to go into any detail about the victims. Everyone, in a sense, is covered. Everyone could potentially be a victim of torture. The question of following or departing from the convention, It's a question for me of if we can improve on the convention, and particularly if we can apply our own constitutional understanding of certain things to this convention, then we should do so. Not that the convention is in any way bad. I think that, as I've suggested, it's in the definition, it's better than what's in this bill, it's clearer than what's in this bill. But if the convention in another way happens to fall short of our understanding or our approach to things, there's nothing to stop us improving on it or making a change. I don't see any problem with that. There's no call for us to sort of slavishly follow what happens to be in the convention. The word only in clause 3, that may fulfill the purpose. I have a something in the back of my mind that just doesn't like that word incidental to. It's something that's incidental. Yes, it's not part of the main purpose of. And that would be the strict definition, but it's too easy just to slip over into it's unimportant, it was a trivial thing, it didn't really matter, it was only incidental. And yet, like I said, that's exactly what that little kind of clap is that the detainee gets from the police officer if he's being geeky, so to speak. Right? And then you start creeping along to ever more serious violations. And I think that if we can bring in the idea of unavoidability, so it doesn't in any way limit the authorities of law and order from carrying out their duties. But they would have to show that the pain and suffering that was caused was indeed unavoidable. I don't think that the word only expresses that as clearly as it needs to be expressed.
Let him respond to Levy's, yes.
Okay, the last set of points were on why only public officials, why are private instances not covered? The convention itself doesn't deal with private torture one citizen to another. The convention limits itself to trying to control the activities of public officials. I don't know enough about international law and how it all works to comment on why that should be, but it seems to me that conventions bind states, and they are binding the officials of states in the states, and they're not binding me in my private capacity. In any event, any act of torture is already, by definition, an act of assault, and a threat of assault is also an assault. And there's no other things, no doubt, would also be covered by other areas of law if what I am doing constitutes the infliction of mental or psychological anguish on a person. That's also an offence under the Intimidation Act and all sorts of other areas. So it's not as if private citizens who carry out acts which would have been torture if they had been public officials, that they get off the hook. They can't be convicted of torture. They can be convicted of a range of other offences. And it seems to me that the convention proceeds from that starting point. And lastly, the question of torture and the heat of the moment. I agree, I think in most cases, of course, it is the kind of thing that's sort of thought out or becomes habitual, is a way of acting. But if you look again at the wording of the definition, there would be instances where it could very well happen in the heat of the moment. It's an act inflicted to punish a person for an act he or she has committed or suspected having committed. And again, one can easily envisage the prison warder, the police officer, in the heat of the moment, on the street, responds, lashes out. You did something naughty there, and I'm going to give you a clap for that, or whatever. I'm going to kick you or something. We know this all the time. It can happen very much in the heat of the moment, even if we would normally think of it as an offence which is carried out very carefully in some sort of controlled environment for a very clear purpose, etc., etc. The definition certainly covers, so say, heat of the moment.
If you will allow me to a further exchange of views for our edification, my edification. Torture is an egregious form of gross human rights violation. We have, as the preamble says, a sample history of it in this country. What the preamble doesn't say and preambles won't say is that unfortunately the phenomenon has continued, and it is deplorable that we haven't yet domesticate the convention into our law. One bows also, of course, to the experience of the institution that you represent, but in the distant past. My question to you is this. I understand the excellent good impulse that would cause people to wish to expand the definition and legally the application. Legally, there's nothing that stands in the way of doing that. But here's my question. Is there not a danger of devaluing the crime? And it truly is an egregious form of human rights violation. It truly is, I don't know, perhaps the most awful of all crimes. Is there not a danger of devaluing it if we start expanding it, if we start applying it to other phenomena in society which are also appalling, but which arguably should be dealt with as part of the normal criminal law? Is there not such a danger?
I guess that the answer is yes, there is that danger. The question would then be, how do you so define torture as to prevent it becoming some sort of cover-all and to prevent just about every physical assault and insult and cause of pain or anguish or suffering by a public official falling under the definition of torture? How do you narrow it and yet come up with a definition which really does zero in on the crime itself, where it is carried out? And I don't think that there would be any easy answer for that. Well, the convention's wording in itself is very, very wide, and a huge range of acts carried out by public officials, which, as I said earlier, they may not even recognize to be more than just a tiny bit wrong. would fall foul of the convention's definition, just as they fall foul of the bill's definition. The bill's definition and the conventions are in effect the same. It's just that there's been the separation out of the perpetrator question into our definition section. But the wording is almost completely identical. You could put them back together quite easily. But I think that I would agree with the point that you raised, that this happens, I think, whenever a new statute comes onto the books that defines a crime and perhaps displaces some of the other crimes. That, for example, how would you make the choice between prosecuting a person under these provisions, under the provisions of common law on assault, or perhaps a whole bunch of other statutory crimes? That would be a decision that the prosecutors would have to take according to a set of circumstances. For me, what needs to be zeroed in on here is the acts of public officials, particularly in the sphere of law and order, that they fully understand where the limits are to what they can do and the kind of conditions under which they carry out their duties, and as I said, what the limits are and why those limits exist. If that can be got right, then when there is a police officer, prison warder, whoever it may be, oversteps the boundaries, well then the relevant authorities can decide, do we go for this in terms of torture? Is it really amount to torture, or was it simply a common assault and we follow it up that way?
Thank you, that's useful.
Going. Alright. Pilana Machaka.
Thanks, Chair. Looking at the submission, I think it's a main idea just to avoid impunity on the part of the state and state officials. I do believe that the additions will actually add much more substance to the bill. The further clarification and explanation of pain and suffering, that actually adds unavoidable or reasonably unavoidable. What is a bit mind-boggling is your suggestion around the attempt to commit torture. Because basically if there's going to be some kind of evidence that torture has taken place, I think then it therefore means that the provisions of the bill will then apply. Also, what I thought you'd actually, I would actually want you to clarify on is 4-5. What's your input around it? No one shall be punished for disobeying an order to commit torture. Because already under 3B, it's indicated that even under legal obligation, you will actually still be charged for torture. It wouldn't be reason enough not to be charged. So there can never be anything that predetermines impunity. Thank you.
Once again, I'm afraid I didn't quite follow one aspect in this. What the Honourable Member mentions about the question of attempt to commit torture, I don't recall that he said anything about an attempt as such.
On your page 3, 2.3, offences and penalties. We are less convinced about the correctness of 4.3.B. That's what I mean. Just need clarity around that.
I think that what we're saying there is, as I said in the middle of that second paragraph, when a junior official unwillingly carries out an act of torture under orders from a superior, especially when, if he or she does carry them out, there and then they risk being punished, then there's a distinct difference in moral blameworthiness. The person giving the order, the person in the superior position, is surely more morally blameworthy than the person that he or she has, in a sense, bullied or forced into carrying out the act itself. So I'm trying to make that distinction there. On the level of, say, of moral blameworthiness. Both of those people are guilty of committing the offence of torture, there's no doubt about that. But one surely deserves a higher level of punishment, because they have given the order, they have forced the junior, the foot soldier, into carrying it out. And as I said, I think whenever our courts impose punishment, one of the things they look at is, you know, what is your level of responsibility here? And clearly, if you, for example, if you were to take it in the prison situation, you have somebody in charge of a unit in a prison, and they have three or four warders under them. And that person in charge says, okay, today I'm going to sort out these prisoners, they're causing a lot of trouble, and I'm going to deal with them. And he ordered his subordinates to assault them. They're young people, they are not as qualified or as experienced as he is. They're in fear of their jobs or of their positions. They fear that he may victimize them if they don't do what he says. They've got a vague idea that they shouldn't be doing this, but the boss, the captain, the colonel, whoever it is ordering me to it, and they do it. All of those people are guilty of torture. I say that the person giving the orders is in a sense more guilty and must be punished more than the foot soldier. The bill as it stands makes no provision for that distinction. Your other point about 4 points.
Let me get up on that one.
Oh, yeah.
To say, I would then therefore say that we should actually include level of responsibility.
Yes,
Four point B.
Yes.
Is it B now?
I think that, well, in my view, you could take off 4.3d out without in any way weakening the substance of the bill. Because that would simply mean then that the fact that a person was under a legal obligation to obey a manifestly unlawful order could be taken into account as a mitigatory factor once it came to sentence. Doesn't have to be taken into account, and again, the court would have the discretion to say, look, you must have known that was manifestly unlawful. There was no particular pressure on you under the circumstance to carry out that order. You weren't being bullied or forced into it. You chose to do it willingly. And then it doesn't, the fact that the person was a subordinate doesn't become mitigating. All I'm saying is that 4.3b robs a court of the discretion that it should have to match the punishment to the level of moral blameworthiness. And 4.5, no one shall be punished for disobeying an order to commit torture. Well, that clearly is a protection for any public official who quite rightly decides not to obey the order to commit torture and is then subsequently made subject to disciplinary action, or it loses their job or whatever. This is a protection for such a person, and obviously one would support its presence very strongly.
Thank you. I think it's a valid point on the 4.1b to some degree C, because the attempt, if you have murder, for example, common law murder, attempted murder is a separate offence for which you can be convicted. Mm-hmm. Here what we are saying in the statute offence is attempt to commit torture is torture itself. So one would need to look at that carefully as we go along when we deliberate about it. Clearly, in the conviction side, you would have mitigating circumstances where it is a mere attempt. But it's, as it is formulated here, the mere attempt is the full offence, as distinct from our common law background, where you would have attempt to commit the crime is itself a separate offence. So I think we need to look carefully at that. So I think it's a valid point. Thank you.
Okay. Well, if there's no more, then it's for me to say, Advocate Podia, thank you to you and your support team and the Catholic Bishops Conference. And your good wife accompanying you today. Yours was one of the first I read, and there's much in it that I agree with. But we'll see how we'll progress.
Thank you very much, Jefferson.
I'm going to do a bit of rearranging of furniture here. I should have insisted that Advocate Potty sit somewhere here so that he addresses the committee members directly. If there's a change of seats now with the next person appearing before us, that is Women's Legal Center and others, are they here? Yes.
I
No. I'm going to ask you to come here.
Maybe with the rearranging, maybe the state law advisors could move.
Yeah, down.
I don't know if there's only one presenter now, but
are
other presenters
alone?
Might have.
If you could move down one and allow others to do likewise, I would greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
I mean, I can understand why the state law advisors would want to sit together, so can't just space be made for them there? In other words, I don't know if two gentlemen there can move down and the lady. No. So you stay where you are.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying they let. How many state law advisors you've got? Three.
Three.
No, you see, there might be, they might expand. So just if
yes.
Just move down that way.
Okay, guys. Sorry about that. Please bear with us. We like this committee room, but when you have a full house, it's a bit of a challenge. More or less settled, and so if you could, don't be intimidated by that. If you could switch back on there, if you could identify yourself or introduce yourself and your team.
Good morning and thank you. I'm Stacey Limanuk. I'm an attorney with the Women's Legal Center, and my colleagues who are here today is from SWET and Sisonke. Sukozo is here with me from SWET, as well as Nomad Unison Drew from Sisonke. I just wanted to start off quickly by thanking you for allowing us this opportunity to present. And our interest in this bill is how it will protect sex workers who experience torture by police officers. WLC provides services to sex workers, and we found that the human rights violation that sex workers experience by theft amounts to torture and inhumane, cruel and degrading treatment. So we use the experiences of sex workers to inform suggestions and amendments to this bill. Sex workers are a marginalized group, and they should be protected from torture regardless of the illegality of the work. The definition of torture is the intentional infliction of severe mental or physical suffering by a public official, directly or indirectly, for a specific purpose. Sex workers have reported that they experience severe mental or physical suffering by SAPs who harass or intimidate them. So sex workers have reported that they experience assault in the form of severe beating or pepper spray in the genitals, eyes and ears, as well as sexual assault in the form of exchange for release. Some have even reported being shot at by rubber bullets. Sex workers experience these kinds of abuses because of the criminality of their work, and it's hard to enforce the Sexual Offences Act as it stands, so the police resort to illegal or intrusive policing practices, which amounts to human rights violations. We've done a research study, which I have made available to you, and in that we've listed statistics of the human rights abuses that we've monitored over a 2-year period. And we found that sex workers do in fact experience high levels of violence by the police. 44 said that they've been assaulted out of 308. 6 said that they've been bribed for sexual favors, and 102 were dashed. Therefore, we have recommended in the aggravating factors of the goal that we include whether the complainant suffered mental or physical harm relating to the cumulative effect of repeated harassment or sexual coercion. The reason why we mention the cumulative effect of repeated harassment is because sex workers is that they're often regularly harassed and targeted by police officers. So many have said that they've had more than 2 encounters with police officers in a 1 month period. And that form of harassment is severe. With regards to cruel and inhumane treatment of sex workers, there are many human rights violations that they experience that might not necessarily amount to torture. And in the preamble of the bill, we mentioned cruel and inhumane treatment. So in these situations, the prohibition of other forms of cruel and inhumane treatment or degrading treatment may apply. And many of these violations occur during detention. And the definition of cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment is any harsh or neglectful treatment that could damage a detainee's physical or mental health, or any punishment intended to cause physical or mental pain or suffering, or to humiliate or degrade the person. So, sex workers have reported that when they are detained, often unlawfully, they experience a number of human rights violations. So, many have said that they were denied medical assistance after they have been beaten or tortured by police officers. Many have reported bad conditions of the cells in the form of dirty cells, being told that they had to drink out of toilet pots, for example. Some have said, 94 sex workers said that they have not received food or water during the time that they were detained, and 64 said that they were held longer than 48 hours. So therefore, we have recommended that in the bill we include cruel and inhumane treatment of sex workers. And that's it for me. Thank you.
Honourable members, Mr. Jeffrey.
Sure, thanks. Look, I mean, I'm very sympathetic to, you know, the concerns you raise relating to the treatment, the illegal treatment of sex workers. But the sense I get is that in making submissions on this bill, you're sort of, which is I suppose correct, looking at every opportunity to popularize and highlight the cause that you're addressing. And is it really appropriate? I mean, effectively what we're doing with this bill is legislating into our domestic law the Convention Against Torture. Is it really appropriate that the issues you raise relating to the treatment of sex workers should form part of the specific subject matter of this bill? Who else is then going to come? Is it not then giving it a completely different perspective? I mean, to my mind, all probably of the issues that you're raising are crimes already. The issue is the monitoring to ensure that those crimes are punished. And I do note that, for example, in the book that you've given to us, with your research, and a lot of that research is in your submission, you don't actually have any mention of this convention. You've got a section on page 19 on international law. You've got two sections. You've got the general case for law reform, but that's arguing more for decriminalization. And then under international law, you're raising concerns relating to compliance with the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. There's no mention of the Convention of Against Torture. So I'm sympathetic to the issues that you're raising, but I just sort of feel, is it really appropriate in this bill? And if it was so appropriate, why, it does look like something you've thought about recently. Why is there no mention of it in your report, which came out in August?
Anybody else? No.
Thank you. Yes, the report we started drafting last year, and you know, we should have mentioned it in the report, but with regards to talking about sex workers' issues here, we've just used what we've seen that is happening to sex workers to inform suggestions for this book. So things like continued harassment, could that possibly be torture? Because of the mental, severe mental suffering that that may cause to a person. And also, in the, as my colleague noted, in the convention, sorry, it says that, that it's supposed to protect the certain minority or marginalized individuals or populations at risk of torture. And there have been other international organizations who have recognized sex workers as a marginalized group. And so we've just used their experiences with the police to inform some of the suggestions. So things like the harassment and conditions in the cells, the severe, and what that causes in terms of severe mental or physical suffering.
Mr. Swart.
One of your suggestions is that all evidence obtained under acts of torture will be inadmissible in criminal proceedings brought against the victim of torture. Is that not the current law at the moment? As I understand it, I think it is, whilst it might be useful to re-emphasize the current applicable law, but it's not strictly necessary to insert such a clause. Would you agree with that? Thank you. Thanks.
Ms. Schiffer?
I mean, the thing is, harassment doesn't constitute torture. I mean, torture is for a specific purpose, and I share concerns of Mr. Jeffrey in that respect. I mean, the issue, if they're wrong, they're wrong, but it's not necessarily amount to torture. And the thing about the conditions of the cells, I mean, that applies to anybody who's detained there, not specifically sex workers.
I think the problem is that with regards to sex workers, police officers, they commit these acts with impunity. And when they approach sex workers, they remove all forms of identification, so it's really difficult to bring them to book. Also, with regards to it already being a crime, it is problematic in that we can't, it's very difficult to ensure that sex workers see justice. And like we said, we've used those experiences and the things that they've reported to us to inform the suggestions.
Ms. Pilar Jack.
Thanks, Chair. I am of the opinion that cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment needs to be punishable, but I find it difficult to see how we will be in the position to bring it into this bill. Taking into consideration the definition already, that has just been unplugged from the International Convention. Because once we actually have to go this route, it is therefore then mean that even the definition itself needs to be reworked. Like my colleagues, I'm very sympathetic with the cause of sex workers, but I do believe that maybe we can find its place somewhere, not in this book.
You wish to respond, or?
I'm just looking for the section where you mentioned that in our submission. I think it was point 5, that we include a section that says for the purposes of this act, truly inhumane or degrading treatment or punishment means, and then that we list what that is in order to make that a crime too. I don't know how that, perhaps the writers could assist us with how that would work. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey.
It's really a suggestion. I don't know if you've acted on it yet, but I think it would be very useful if you approached the Police Portfolio Committee, because it's predominantly the police. I don't think it's so much of an issue with other elements of the justice system. Approach the Police Portfolio Committee and ask them to make a presentation on the report and to get formal responses from the police, South African Police Service, as to their treatment of sex workers. But I think that would be a very appropriate
a more appropriate method of trying to deal with the problem. I don't know if you've looked at that as yet, but that's something I would really urge.
Actually, I'd agree with that. I think what is said out there is shocking, and to what degree that the police seem to be immune. And I personally would like to know somehow what happens when criminal charges are laid, but at the very least to have a submission before the police portfolio committee, so that these are raised and monitored from Parliament's side. Also, to what degree the inspectorate of the police are able to investigate all complaints and what happens along the course, because what you said out here I find shocking. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's brought us to the end of your submission, and we thank you heartily. No doubt you'll take the members' comments for human rights.
Thank you, Chair, for affording us this opportunity as lawyers for human rights to come and share our views and concerns in regard to draft deal. I need to mention, Chairperson, that our submissions here are endorsed by a number of organizations that I will mention, which include the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa, Nelson Mandela Metropolitan University Refugee Rights Center, the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, the University of Cape Town Refugee Rights Unit, Scalabrini Center of Cape Town, and Refugee Social Services. My name is Lesirela Letere. I'm an attorney at Lawyers for Human Rights, and I'm with me here Mr. Mangin Nabugo, who is our candidate attorney. Mr. Chairperson, there are a number of points that I would want to address in particular here, which I want to just mention in handset, which include the definition in relation to what constitutes acts of torture. That was the first. The second, offenses and penalties. The first, extraterritorial jurisdiction, and that will give examples of case law that we are aware of, which we have dealt with currently. We'll also deal with prevention mechanisms, as well as non-refoulement, principle of non-refoulement, and lastly, the redress, compensation, and rehabilitation. Mr. Chairperson, in extending our gratitude and being given this opportunity to come and share these views and concerns, we recall South Africa's colonial and apartheid history, where state-sponsored violence and torture was commonplace. We also remind the Department of Justice and the Justice Portfolio Committee that it was the torture of Steve Biko which gave the impetus for the drafting of the Convention Against Torture. We must emphasize that the fact that South Africa is a constitutional democracy is no guarantee against torture and other cruel, inhuman or degrading treatment. Recall recent reports which suggest that the practice of torture and other cruel and inhuman or degrading treatment by South African police services and other agencies are widespread. I will now begin with a point I first mentioned earlier, which relates to Section 3, the definition of acts that constitute torture. The definition of torture outlined in the bill departs from the definition outlined in the convention. In the convention, The bill seeks to limit the definition as applicable to state parties and those acting on behalf of state parties. There appears to be reasonable grounds for this limitation, and the definition should, you know, be applicable to all persons. The bill further seeks to limit the definition to include only torture committed by a public official. Officials or persons acting on behalf of public officials. The convention definition is much wider and includes any person irrespective of whether they are state officials or not. There is no justification for the limitation of the applicability of this bill to public officials only. Non-state actors can and must be accountable for their actions in the same way as state officials. We therefore recommend that the bill follows the convention definition more closely, especially with regard to the inclusion of non-state actors. Our second point, Chairperson, is with regard to offences and penalties in Section 4. We say the section on offences and penalties, in contrast, applies equally to public officials and non-state actors, but the definition as outlined above does not. We would recommend the drafting of this section to clarify that these offences and penalties are applicable to public officials and non-state actors alike in the following way, and this is our suggestion. This will be Section 4, Subsection 1. To say, any person who, and then I will continue from there. So in other words, the public official is put aside with the word person to include everybody. So LHR recommends that the bill removes a public official and to replace it with person to extend the scope of the bill to all persons and not only the state actors. We would also recommend the addition of the following subsection to Section 4. And this will read Section 4, Subsection in our suggestion. An order from a superior officer or public authority may not be invoked as a justification of torture. Our next item, Mr. Chairperson, is with regard to extraterritorial jurisdiction. And we say that we find Section 6 to be problematic in that the bill states that a South African court will only have jurisdiction over these categories of persons, namely a citizen, person who is ordinarily resident, person who is lawfully present, or person who has committed an act against a citizen or ordinary resident. This section also contradicts two recent court judgments on extraterritorial jurisdiction, which need to be considered and incorporated into the bill. We would recommend the addition in Section 6 sub 1b of foreigner or any other person who are within the territory of the state. Under Article 7.1 of the Convention, Article 7.1 of the Convention states are required to submit cases of torture to its competent authorities for purpose of prosecution, irrespective of the existence of a prior request for the extradition of the suspect. If the state in whose territory the suspect is present has received a request for extradition in any of the cases envisaged in the provisions of the Convention, it can relieve itself of its obligation to prosecute any acceding to that request. Prosecute by acceding to that request. So while extradition is an option offered to the state by the Convention, prosecution is an international obligation under the Convention, the violation of which is a wrongful act engaging the responsibility of the state. We proceed to say Section 6 of the bill gives the South African courts the jurisdiction to try suspects. According to Section 6 of the bill, South Africa will have jurisdiction over persons who have committed torture, even if the torture was committed outside the Republic, against non-citizens and the perpetrator is himself or herself not a citizen or lawfully resident in the country. The only requirement for jurisdiction should be that the perpetrator be present on South African territory, according to Section 6.1c, and that the prosecution of the perpetrator be endorsed by the written authority of the National Director of Public Prosecutions, in 6.2. However, the bill does not expressly acknowledge the international obligation that it has to try or extradite. Establishment of jurisdiction does not necessarily establish the obligation to make use of such jurisdiction to try all suspects. Should no request for extradition be made or should no request for extradition be accepted. Where a person suspected of torture is present in the territory, South Africa has only the discretion to accept an extradition request. The state's discretionary power stretches further under international law. If extradition is impossible, there is an obligation to investigate and prosecute locally. Bail also does not provide for anticipated arrival of the perpetrators as a ground to found jurisdiction of South Africa courts. Experience has shown that when knowledge of the arrival of a torture suspect has been obtained by the South African authorities, it is important to begin the process of investigation and preparation of court documents in order to begin the court process upon their arrival. This ground for jurisdiction provides a vital tool for South African authorities tasked with responsibilities in terms of the bill. As such, we recommend the following with regard to the bill, that the bill must expressly acknowledge the obligation to try and or extradite suspects. Secondly, the National Director of Public Prosecutions should not have the discretion to try or not in circumstances where a suspect cannot be extradited. Thirdly, in order for the convention obligation to have meaningful force, it would perhaps be wise to place a temporal limit on the obligation to try or extradite. In other words, if extradition request is made, we must either accept it or undertake to try domestically within a defined time period, e.g. within 2 years of the request being refused. Fourthly, where the state is unwilling to pursue or prosecute a perpetrator, the state is our suggestion that it must issue a non-prosecutory certificate to allow for a private prosecution as appropriate. Fifthly, we recommend inclusion of the ground of anticipated presence of a suspect within South African territory as described in Section 6 to found jurisdiction and begin the process upon his or her arrival. We give us a way of example as regards this issue. The two cases that the NHR has been involved in, the first being the Minister of Home Affairs versus Emmanuel Tebe and others. The second being the Zimbabwe Project docket, which is recorded as South African Litigation Center and other versus the National Director of Public Prosecutions and others. Starting with the Tebe matter, in this case, which dealt with the extradition or deportation of accused persons to countries where they may face the death penalty, the Constitutional Court held that South Africa may not send a person back to a country if that country has not given the requisite assurance that this individual would not face the death penalty. The court went on to say that the subject extradition protocol contemplates that a state that is a party to that protocol may refuse to extradite a person in that situation. The court considered the need to bring someone to justice with the protection that the constitution of the constitution affords against the death penalty in country. The court stated that under international law, until Botswana, who as it stands now supports the death penalty for serious crimes, until it is able to give the requisite assurance that a person sought by them will not receive the death penalty, South Africa is entitled to decline to surrender this wanted person. The court said that there is a power which the Justice Minister has in terms of Section 9 of the Extradition Amendment Act 77 of 1996. The court also pronounced upon the obligation to deport an illegal foreigner in terms of the Immigration Act and stated that these obligations must be read consistently with the Constitution and cannot require the deportation of a person in circumstances where that deportation would be a breach of the Constitution. In the interest of fugitives evading punishment for committing serious crimes, the court recommended the passing of legislation to give South African courts jurisdiction to try certain specified offences despite the fact that they were committed outside South Africa. The court listed two pieces of legislation which have been passed in this regard, namely the Prevention and Combating of Corrupt Activities Act 12 of 2004 and the Implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court Act 27 of 2002. The court's reasoning was that if South Africa could pass legislation to give its courts jurisdiction to try crimes which have been committed outside South Africa, there is no reason why similar legislation cannot or should not be put in place to ensure that persons who have committed crimes serious enough to attract the death penalty in other countries can be tried by the South African courts when countries in which they allegedly committed these crimes are not prepared to give the requisite assurance. Such legislation would prevent a situation where South Africa became a safe haven for persons alleged to have committed serious crimes like murder. South Africa would in this way also be discharging its obligations under the static extradition protocol. The second case that I mentioned earlier, which is South African litigation center and another, is the National Director of Public Prosecutions and others, dealt with this issue as follows. The situation of extraterritorial jurisdiction has been developed in the above case where the High Court held that the South African authorities have a duty to investigate Zimbabwean officials implicated in acts of torture in that country. The judgment makes it clear that the South African government cannot turn a blind eye to systematic torture in a neighboring country where the victims could not be protected. The court emphasized that there is a clear obligation on South Africa to, in terms of the Rome Statute, investigate and prosecute these human rights abuses. The judgment made it possible for not only the prosecution of Zimbabwean torture perpetrators, but also for the SA government to investigate any other human rights abuses outside South Africa, where it was possible that the offenders may reach SA voters. The case set a much broader precedent, Honorable Chairperson, by ruling that South African authorities have a duty to investigate international crimes wherever they take place. In line with these two cases, it would be prudent for the bill to also incorporate Article 3 of the Convention. The next point that I deal with, Chairperson, is with regard to prevention mechanisms. I state that section two of the prevention and combating of torture bill, one of the objects of which is to prevent and combat torture. I rephrase that. You say section two sub C of prevention and combating of torture and CIDT. One of the objects of the bill, in terms of that, is to prevent and combat torture. However, the bill does not provide for clear proactive mechanisms to prevent torture. The prevention of torture forms an important part of the object of the bill, contained in Section 21A, Roman Figure 2. This section mirrors a similar provision in the Convention that requires South Africa to take effective legislative, administrative, judicial and other measures to prevent torture. It is therefore clear that the scope of the bill should go beyond just the criminalization of torture. Much has been written about the effectiveness of independent monitoring of places of detention in preventing torture and ill treatment. A good example of such a preventative mechanism is the Judicial Inspectorate of Correctional Services, which was established in terms of the Correctional Services Act and operates through a network of independent prison visitors around the country. Unfortunately, this body's mandate is limited to prisons and does not include police cells, youth care centers, military detention, and places of administrative detention, such as immigration holding facilities like Lindela and psychiatric hospitals. The protocol to the Torture Convention, which SA has signed but not ratified, contains provisions for the establishment of a national preventative mechanism which gives effect to the obligation in Section 2 to take effective preventative measures. Accordingly, we urge Parliament to consider the inclusion of a statutory framework for the establishment of such a preventative or detention monitoring mechanism. In addition to the domestic mechanism, it is also important for the bill to emphasize government's duty to cooperate with the various relevant UN and AU treaty monitoring bodies. For example, the UN Committee Against Torture, Special Rapporteurs, African Commission on Human and People's Rights. Therefore, we propose that the bill creates a national preventative mechanism as described in the OPCA, which South Africa has signed but not ratified, as earlier referred to. The need for an for such mechanism body is apparent with situations such as the Lindela partition facility and other military detention facilities where there are virtually no oversight mechanisms and no redress for victims of torture. We now proceed to deal with the principle of non-refoulement. The Extradition Act 67 of 1962 regulates extradition and agreements. The detention and deportation of foreign nationals is governed by the Immigration Act 13 of 2002 and impacted by the Refugees Act 130 of 1998. These pieces of legislation do not provide for non-refoulement where there are substantial grounds for believing that the person to be deported or extradited would be in danger of being subjected to torture, as thus the convention in Article 3. The courts, including the Constitutional Court, have adjudicated such claims on the Bill of Rights, especially the rights of life, dignity and liberty. The Bill should incorporate Article 3 so as adequately reflect the requirements laid down in the case law. We proceed to deal with the issue with of redress, compensation and rehabilitation of those affected. The bill is silent on this point and needs to outline clear measures to redress. The bill is silent on this of redress available. We recommend that the bill incorporate both Article 13 and 14 of the Convention. And as subclasses under this item, we deal with reparations for victims and family members. And we say adequate and appropriate forms of reparations for victims and survivors of torture and their families must include restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, satisfaction, and guarantees of non-repetition. And with regard to restitution, with the restoration of liberties and employment, these are the factors that will feature with regard to the restitution of those that are affected. In the event that a victim is or a family member are unable to find employment because of the physical, mental, and emotional effect of torture, victims must have access to state support grants. With regard to compensation, for damages equal to the gravity of the offense, inclusive of medical care, lost employment, and lost education opportunities. And for rehabilitation, we say medical, psychological, and legal forms for victims of torture must be factored in. These rehabilitation services need not be solely provided by the state. The victim's right to choose a service provider should be upheld. Psychotherapeutic services need not be confined to clinical counseling alone. Psychological services should include families of victims of torture as the impacts extend beyond the victim. Counseling services should be holistic and include the services of interdisciplinary professionals such as counselors, psychologists, and psychiatrists. Such services should be available over a long period of time as healing is a long journey. Satisfaction, right to the truth and full disclosure, apology and public accountability for families of victims and survivors. This must be satisfied. Guarantees for non-repetition, rehabilitation of perpetrators must be made to the victims. Those are our submissions, Mr. Chairperson. And may I mention that to the extent that the Honorable Chairperson, other members might wish to ask questions on this. I happen not to be in the best position to provide answers to such questions at this stage. Ms. Kajal Ramjagan, who was supposed to come here on behalf of this, of HR and the group, was unable to fly over here to address any such questions as may avail. But we are available to note such questions. And to the extent that is possible for us to answer such questions, we might try to answer such questions, but that should be put in mind.
Okay. Mr. Swart, Mr. Jeffrey, Prof. Ndavandava, in that order.
Thank you, Dave, and thank you for the very extensive submission. And
if there are questions, you might want to note them, and you might want to add your written submission in the light of some of the questions that we put. But firstly, you're on page 6, the court case relating to the Zimbabwe torture case is very useful for us to consider, and it would be interesting for us as a committee, because we are dealing with a torture bill at some stage, to find out what is the outcome and to what degree has the NDPP complied with this court order. We are dealing with torture, so it's a very important aspect.
But is it on appeal?
Yes. I think there is, but that maybe you can, we can look into. I think there is an appeal, it could have been an appeal lodged, but in the interim what is happening. But the point that you make here is very important, and your submission where you recommend an insertion on the next page also deals with the second issue, and that is the allegations of rendition that took place from South Africa to Zimbabwe, which clearly is something that we need to take cognizance of when we are dealing with this bill. It's a very important point, and so we will look very carefully at your suggestion in that regard. Can I just then ask you on the issue relating to liability, where for compensation, now there is a clause in the bill that refers to liability, and that's clause 7 that you might want to look at. I think your submission indicates that you would like to see broader compensation than purely that exists in terms of common law, where you can claim for damages, institute a civil action. And you might want to look at what we put into the combating of human trafficking legislation, where there are specific clauses there for restitution, return for persons, and I think that might be useful, which is over and above what we've got in Section 300 of the Criminal Procedure Act. Then the last aspect that I just wanted to ask you on, and you might want to reflect on, you refer to the very important definition of torture, and your submission is that the definition in terms of the International Convention is wider than merely related to state actors. Now, my reading of that definition seems to indicate that it is only state actors. Now, I'm not unmindful that in our deliberations we might decide that our definition should be wider and include private actors, but you might want to look at your reasoning again and give us another submission as to why you say that the United Nations definition includes private actors. My reading of that is very clear that it refers to a public official or other persons acting in an official capacity. I don't see that wide reading there, but it's not to say that we are not sympathetic to your submission, that we might want to consider inserting private actors, but that would be further than, in my submission, the United Nations definition goes. Thank you, Chairperson.
Mr. Chairman. Well, I'll start on that last point. It was just to get clarity on what basis are you saying that the convention definition is wider, and that you recommend that the convention, you effectively say that appears to be no reasonable grounds for this limitation, the definition should be applicable to all persons, whereas as Mr. Swart has said, my reading of the convention is public official, any person acting in an official capacity. Our aspect is public official, and then public official is defined as a person holding public office and exercising or purporting to exercise a public power. Any person acting in a capacity, and then anyone acting with a consent or acquiescence. Surely if we have the bill applicable to everybody, we're going way beyond the convention and possibly reducing the intent of the convention, which was to prevent state torture or state-sponsored torture. So that's one. Secondly, then, if I've understood you correctly, you know, this issue of jurisdiction. If I'm understanding you correctly, you want to basically, want South Africa to have the responsibility to try any alleged torturer who happens to arrive in the country. And you again seem to quote the convention as providing for that. I'd want to get clarity as to where are you finding that in the convention. I mean, my reading of Article 5 refers to each state party shall take measures as may be necessary to establish its jurisdiction over the offences referred in Article 4, that's torture, in the following cases. One, where the offence is committed in any territory under its jurisdiction or on board a ship or aircraft registered to that state. Two, when the alleged offender is a national of that state. 3, when the victim was a national of that state, if the state considers it appropriate. My reading of the convention, you know, then 2, each part, state party shall take measures as may be necessary to establish its jurisdiction over such offences. Because, I mean, are you expecting a situation, let's say Mr. George W. Bush arrives here, and I won't use a more more topical cases, but let's say Mr. George W. Bush arrives here, would you have an expectation that South Africa should arrest him for torture committed in Iraq by American forces? It may be fine, but it's also linked to the Constitutional Court, the recent judgment, the Zebra case. To try somebody here, you then got to collect all the evidence and costs of that. You've also got to get cooperation from the place where that crime was committed to bring the evidence here. And given that we've got our justice system has some problems processing crimes committed in South Africa, should we really be looking at wanting to put an obligation on the NPA to start prosecuting any torture case committed in the rest of the world just because the torturer happens to be in South Africa? Is that actually practical? I mean, it might be nice in theory, but is it actually practical? I'm not sure what other countries have done this. I know when Spain attempted to prosecute General Pinochet when he arrived, that it was based on crimes committed against Spanish nationals in Chile. But I'm not aware of anybody else who has this sort of general attitude of okay, well, X tortured Y in Uzbekistan, and X has now arrived in Britain, France, Germany, United States, whatever, let's prosecute X for that torture, let's send off people to Uzbekistan to go and collect the evidence. So yeah, I'm just sort of quite worried about the practical implications of that, and are there any other countries in the world that have that much wider jurisdiction? So basically those questions, and are you really reading the convention correctly in that regard when the convention specifically lists 3 scenarios where they say jurisdiction must be founded, and that's basically territory, aircrafts or ships, a victim is a national, a perpetrator is a national.
On your submission, page 4, part 4, extraterritorial jurisdiction, you say that we recommend the addition of illegal foreigners or any other persons who are within the territory or the state, section 61B. Now, my small question here is, what are your views about illegal legal persona, because you speak here of those 2 types of persons. Could you comment on that, please?
Okay, I will limit myself to answer 2 questions, your last question and your recent question. As for the others, I've taken note of that, and I wouldn't want to diverge from what my other colleagues who made an input to this submission would have said had they been here. As regard whether it's practical or not for South Africa to be expected to arrest and prosecute someone who, as a way of example, gave Mr. George Bush. I would say the fact that it may not have yet happened elsewhere in the world, and that it may not be particularly correct to do so, does not as such suggest that it cannot legally be done, and that South Africa cannot serve as such an example, so that other countries elsewhere can follow, having seen how South Africa would handle such a situation. So I'm just saying that on the top of my mind, that truly it can be tested, it can be tried, and it can be an example if it was not done this way.
Even in a country that battles with getting its own judicial system, criminal law process system, criminal justice system rather, working for offences committed here?
Doesn't it diminish the nature of the offence that that person would have committed? It still remains a crime that was committed elsewhere, and of which South Africa would have an international obligation to prosecute.
Under
Rome,
yes. That's different.
Yes.
Okay. Please, honourable members, try not to intimidate our guests.
Okay, I hope for now I will still be stuck with the belief that the fact that South Africa has not seen it happening elsewhere should not actually intimidate it to start and serve as such an example to guide other nations. Okay. You mentioned the issue of legal persons. I don't understand legal. The juristic person is legal person. Are we talking about which kind of a person? Because I understand. Not a natural person. Okay. In what way? I would understand that legal persons might be implicated in as far as funding activities that violate the international convention. So to an extent that they may be repeated in that way, it would be quite difficult to litigate unless the directors of that jurisdiction can be located from within our jurisdiction, or else travel over to South Africa for whatever business activities, and then we then obtain jurisdiction by virtue of they are now having come over for purposes of prosecution. Because I would imagine if they would not have directors of such entities in South Africa, then the entities might as well not be able to on their own appear before the court for prosecution. But if directors of such companies, such entities, are very well in South Africa and they are found to have perpetrated or funded tortures, I think South Africa would, by extension, also be able to have jurisdiction over such person.
All right. Members of Lawyers for Human Rights, we thank you for your input and for your excellent written submission. I'm sure that it will assist us greatly in our consideration of the bill. Thank you. Right, so who's next? Civil Society Prison Reform Initiative. Can I make a special appeal to you? We've received your written submission. Please believe me when I say this, we've read it. My appeal to you is to highlight the salient points in your written submission that you want the committee to take careful note of. It doesn't mean that if you feel that you have to read your written submission, you shouldn't. That's entirely your choice. But, it's a bit torturous. Might be. We haven't concluded that point yet.
Thank you, Chairperson. No, it was definitely not my intention to go that way through the submission. That would amount at least to ill treatment. So let me just highlight a few of the matters.
Could you introduce yourself?
I was about to talk. I'm Lucas Minden from the Civil Society Prison Reform Initiative at the Community Law Center at the University of the Western Cape. And next is my colleague Gwenelle Vreemaker, also from the Civil Society Prison Reform Initiative. The bill has been, the first version I saw 10 years ago, so we are very happy that it eventually is before Parliament. The thrust of our submission is that when we draft this legislation, it must domesticate South Africa's obligations under the Convention in the most comprehensive manner possible. And the submission deals with that in a fair amount of detail. I think it's also important to bear in mind that the bill of the final legislation will have implications not only for the Department of Justice, but for a range of other departments that has any law enforcement function or deal with people deprived of their liberty. So it's not only police and correctional services, but drug treatment centers, child and youth care centers, and so forth. So, the Convention places four broad duties on South Africa. The first is to criminalize torture and combat impunity. The second is to prevent torture and ill treatment. The third is to provide redress and rehabilitation to victims of torture and other ill treatment. And then lastly, the duty to report to the Committee Against Torture on measures taken to give effect to its obligations under the Convention. And the submission deals with these four broad duties in succession. I'll move by paragraph numbers, so if committee members can just refer to that. And on page 3, I want to emphasize paragraph 8, where it concerns that the duty to combat impunity, so in my copy it's 8, it's 9 in the copy that was circulated. To this end, the criminalization of torture in domestic law needs to specifically take account of a range of measures. I'm not going to go through them in detail, but this is the guidance that states receive from bodies such as the Committee Against Torture, the Special Rapporteur on Torture, and other eminent academics on this particular issue. So if one wants to use this as a checklist, this will be a very useful way of assessing the quality of the legislation criminalizing torture. Just a few brief comments on the definition as well. There's already been comments this morning on the definition and whether to expand it or narrow it down. We essentially submit that it would be wise to use the definition as it is in the Convention, and that there are at least two problems with the version that is currently in the bill. And we're just cross-checking paragraph. And this paragraph 14 raises the first issue, is that the bill omits the phrasing "with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in that capacity." So we feel that that is a problem. In the following paragraph, the bill also omits the phrase "for such purposes as," and actually presents a closed list of intentions or purposes for which torture can be used. We, for that reason, also think that the phrasing in Article 1 of the Convention should be used. In respect of sentencing, and I'm at paragraph 20 of our submission, the bill proposes a list of factors to be taken into consideration in clause 5. It's not clear how courts should use this. It merely lists factors, and there may be very differing opinions on how courts will interpret these factors. The international jurisprudence emphasized the importance of the prohibition of torture as a peremptory norm, and the phrasing in the Convention, as well as in Robben Island guidelines, emphasized that the punishment must reflect the gravity of the crime. And the submission cites various decisions that have emerged over the year that emphasize that point. So, in paragraph 24, we conclude essentially that against this background, a non-custodial sentence would be entirely unsuitable as a punishment for the crime of torture, and that in line with general sentencing norms and tariffs in South Africa, an appropriate punishment should be guided, preferably in the legislation. The Committee Against Torture has not set a certain minimum sentence that must be imposed, even as a guideline, but individual members of the committee has noted that a custodial sentence of between 6 and 20 years is appropriate as a punishment for crime of torture. On the matter of jurisdiction, there are one or two issues we would like to raise there. The first concerns in paragraph 26, that the bill says that a court will have jurisdiction if after the commission of the offence the person is present in the territory of the Republic. This provision puts into effect Article 5.2 of the Convention, but it does not take into account, of acts of work committed on state territory such as ships and so forth. Also, the same clause deals with people who are lawfully in the country, but it does not deal with people who have entered the country unlawfully and suspected of the crime of torture. The bill does not deal a provision on does not provide a provision dealing with evidence obtained under torture. Domestic case law has already dealt with the matter in S versus Ntembu, and I think it would be an essential element of this legislation to especially prohibit the use of evidence obtained under torture. We propose in the submission a particular phrasing there that the committee can consider for inclusion. In paragraph 1, we deal with a particular exemption from the common law. The issue is about how to prove that torture has been committed. And I turn to paragraph 32. That under the common law, the person or relative of the victim who alleges torture must prove that it occurred. In cases of torture, this is often extraordinarily difficult for the complainant to do, for frequently the inquiry boils down to a say-so of the complainant against that of the public official. Accordingly, the bill should exempt the complainant from the ordinary rules of evidence, particularly the evidentiary burden of proof, which in turn should be borne by the state. So we recommend a two-stage inquiry where essentially the state must provide evidence to prove that the crime of torture has not been committed or that the complaint of torture is impossible and therefore frivolous. We propose a particular phrasing there. I then turn to non-refoulement in the submission. From paragraph 36 onwards, this has also been a matter that has been before the courts in Mohammed and more recently in Tsebe, and LHR has already dealt with the issue. I'm not going to repeat it. Then perhaps one of the most difficult areas of dealing with torture is how to provide redress to victims of torture, and the submission goes into a fair amount of detail on this particular issue. I think in this regard we should carefully read what our obligations are under Article 14 of the Convention and tailor legislation that addresses those obligations, but in particular follow the Van Boer van Bassioni principles that include five elements being restitution, compensation, rehabilitation, satisfaction, and guarantees of non-repetition. We also submit that the bill does not contain a definition of what is a victim of torture, and this could again be guided by Van Boer van Bassioni principles. I'm not going to go through all the detail there, and rather move on to the duty to prevent torture. And this is perhaps where we should make or focus our energies on, not only from the level of the legislature but also at operational level, because much can be done indeed to prevent acts of torture and ill treatment. In paragraph 57, to the extent that the bill addresses the prevention of torture, it does not include the provisions such as or similar to the following. And there it deals with government departments that must create, maintain and continuously update policies on torture prevention as well as report claims of and incidences of torture to relevant oversight bodies, National Prosecuting Authority and Parliament. There should be mandatory training on the absolute prohibition of torture. All government institutions that deal with people deprived of their liberty must continuously update and maintain policies and regulations designed to ensure humane conditions of detention, including the systematic review of procedural safeguards. The convention should be translated into all 11 official languages. There should be a general prohibition on the use, production and trade of equipment or substances designed to inflict torture and other ill treatment. Every person has the right to lodge without delay a complaint regarding his or her treatment to an independent authority, including violations of the right to be free from torture and illegal treatment. And that the state must ensure that people who have lodged complaints and witnesses to such complaints are protected from retaliation and intimidation. And then lastly, if there's a prima facie case that an accused committed torture, then he or she should immediately be removed from their place of birth and placed on suspension. Then lastly, the submission deals with the duty to report. It is unfortunately that the case of South Africa has been late, not only in its reporting to the Committee Against Torture. The first report was due in 1999. It was submitted 6 years late in 2005. The next report became due in December 2010. It still has not been submitted. The Committee Against Torture also asked for additional information to be submitted by the end of 2007. That has equally not been submitted. So from our perspective, it is perhaps appropriate that the legislation then deals with the duty to report to ensure that the relevant government departments put in place the necessary systems and capacities so that we can meet our reporting obligations to the Committee Against Torture. That is an overview of our submission, Chairperson. From our side, we would be very glad and willing to assist the Committee with any further written submissions that will support it in its deliberations. Thank you.
Mr. Jeffrey, Mr. Swart, Ms. Smuts, and Ms. Pila and Ms. Jarke, in their order, please.
Okay, thanks. So starting with the paragraph 14, the definition of torture, where you say the definition in the bill omits an important aspect where the torture is committed with the consent or acquiescence of a public official. But that is in the bill under the definition of public official. Public official C, any person acting with the consent or acquiescence of the person contemplated in A or B. So I'm not following what you're saying there. Then, as far as sentencing, I do note that you say while CAS does not prescribe minimum sentences, you're basically saying you want minimum sentences. And is that what you really want? I mean, particularly as the your own organisation on prisons. And then evidence obtained as a result of torture. I mean, it's in our law. Do we need to say anything? And the moment we start, explicitly in the Constitution. Do we need, once we start saying something, then uncertainty could arise as to is this consistent with the Constitution and so on. So do we really need to say anything about that? And then I'm fairly alarmed by your exemption from the common law. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a fundamental tenet of our law, a person's innocence until proven guilty. But what you seem to be saying is a person is innocent until proven guilty except when they're alleged to have committed torture, and then they are guilty until proven innocent. And surely you can't be saying that. I know it may be difficult to collect evidence, although torture usually involves the infliction of bodily injury on people, which is more easier to pick up in a doctor's report. Surely we can't end up with that situation. And then I don't understand what you're saying. If a prima facie case is established, the state must use independent evidence to show that torture did not occur. Now, that's page 11 at the bottom of paragraph 34. Okay, I don't understand that. I mean, the state's job is to prove that there was torture. The defense's job is to prove that there wasn't torture. Why should the state, if the state must establish its prima facie case, why must the state then have the responsibility of getting some expert to say, oh, this person couldn't have been tortured? I mean, surely you mean the defense there, but I'm very alarmed by your proposal that you seem to be saying that a person is guilty of committing torture unless they can prove that they didn't.
Mr. Swart.
Thank you, Chair. I've been largely covered on my concern related to the evidentiary issue and what seemed to be a reverse onus. And the question being, why should this situation be any different to any criminal case against a state official, against any state official, where the state has certain information and it's up to the prosecutors to prove its case beyond reasonable doubt when the civil case on a balance of probability. So I have also difficulty with deviating from the existing evidentiary law, and to what degree would that deviation as suggested be constitutional?
Yeah, can I just quickly add on that one? I mean, let's take rape. It's very difficult to prove. And the circumstances that you've outlined here with torture often relate to rape. Must we then start changing the requirements for the burden of proof or the proof of the crime of rape, that a person is presumed to have committed rape unless they can prove they didn't?
Sorry, Jim, and then just secondly, the issue of the evidence obtained. Could you just help us a little bit with the understanding? Maybe we need to look at that S versus Mpembu, which you recite on page 9. My understanding was that such evidence would be admissible, but it seems that there is a test that's been set out in that SA case that we might need to have a look at. And you mentioned here that SA matter found that evidence obtained as a result of torture of a witness as opposed to the accused was no bar to the subjection of such evidence to the test. So is it correct that there could be a consideration of the usage of such evidence where it is torture of a witness? So then there might be merit to the insertion of your suggestion as on page 9.
Ms. Lentz.
I simply wanted to ask why the point was being made about non-custodial sentences when there are none in the bill. The bill doesn't suggest that there should be. It says it's an offence and the person guilty of the offence torture is on conviction liable to imprisonment, including imprisonment for life, full stop. There's no provision for fines or any other form of sentence. I don't understand why the point is made. And then the other matters have now, I think, quite been exhaustively covered. Can we just look at the question of return or extradition? I don't know why Article 3 hasn't been taken up in this bill, and no doubt we will hear in due course. But one kind of imagines that geopolitical subcontinental considerations might play a role. I mean, there's no way, considering the Mohammed case, which was, 2001, yeah, now followed by Judge Zordo last year, I mean, it applies. It should be, Article 3 should be written into this bill also. But since I suspect that it has to do with our Southern African politics or African politics, can you tell us, since our previous submittant, LHR, didn't have their person here to answer questions, the FADEC extradition protocol does apparently allow states to refuse to extradite where the death penalty is in place. Does it also explicitly refer to torture? Do you happen to know? Have you had a look at that? And this, I can't expect you to answer, but it seems to me that our regional politics must play a role here. And it's an interesting thing that our esteemed Minister of Home Affairs has now become our AU chief. So I wonder, you know, all of this, her positioning may be affected now by her new role and her stewardship of not only the Robben Island guidelines, but the audit protocols. So, it is meer lekker politiek gezellig als in het anders, maar als die dat zegt.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm in support of the idea that the reporting mechanisms should actually be looked into, seeing that the next report is due by December 2012, like you've actually said. This is very important, so that whatever we face to fight, we manage to ensure that we report about, to ensure that we comply to the obligations. Your paragraph 26, that says that the bill does not take into consideration crimes committed in international waters. Do you think that that will be covered by other pieces of legislation? And then another thing is the point that you made in paragraph 20, the punishment must demonstrate gravity of the crime. I think it's quite in line with the submission of the SABC of level of responsibility. So which would therefore mean that coming up again for consideration, which is something that we need to look into. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks. I would just want to, in one sentence, reiterate my horror at the attempt to subvert the common law principle of innocence until proven guilty. But my question really is, what is your view on the Catholic Bishop Conference's submission in respect of that they feel if somebody is being given orders from above and pressurized to commit torture, do you think that they should be taken into account? And if so, would that be as a mitigating factor for penalty?
Thank you, Chairperson. Again, I just want to emphasize, we're trying to promote a piece of legislation that is comprehensive, that is also concise, and hopefully user-friendly, but at least accessible. Let's use the word accessible. So in terms of the definition, yes, the issue of acquiescence is dealt with in the definition of public official, but surely it won't hurt to put to use the definition in Article 1 of the Convention, where it is clearly stated that one can read it in its totality. The issue of sentencing, and I'll try and deal with this as the other with the other questions that were also raised, is it says a person will be liable to a sentence of imprisonment, but in my reading it doesn't exclude suspended prison sentence, for instance. I think the crime of torture is so serious that the legislature should provide guidance to the courts in one way or the other. One can add the crime of torture to the schedules in the Criminal Procedure Act. But I think that is something that we'll leave for the legislature to decide, bearing in mind that the Committee Against Torture has provided some guidance on this, not as a body but as an individual. But I think it smacks in the face of victims of torture when people are seen to be getting away scot-free. And I think that does not sound to send out the right message. The issue of
I know you're coming here as the Committee Against Torture, but the Civil Society Prison Reform Initiative, is it now advocating minimum sentences?
No, Chairperson, no. But we are asking that the punishment should reflect the gravity of the crime, and a suspended prison sentence would not do that. The issue around the reverse onus on the common law principle, in my page 10, paragraph 31, the European Court on Human Rights has said that when an individual is taken into police custody in good health but is found to be injured at the time of release, it's incumbent on the state to provide a plausible explanation of how those injuries were caused.
And it is along those lines that we're saying there must be some explanation from the state. We say, well, how did the person arrive at the police station and he walks out there with a broken arm or other injuries? And it lifts up with the duty to investigate promptly and by impartial authorities. So I don't think it's a case of saying the person is guilty and must prove his innocence, but there must at least be a plausible explanation of how did this happen. Furthermore, it is the state's duty to protect the individual. And the convention applies particularly to the state's duties to prevent and protect individuals. And it is in that sense that the submission approaches it from that angle. Mr. Swartz, you asked about the witness. The Mtembu case specifically dealt, it was a witness that was tortured, and his admissions under torture led to the discovery of evidence that implicated Mtembu, and so it's on that basis that Mtembu's appeal was successful, and the Supreme Court appeal was extremely unhappy because this man had committed armed robbery and theft of vehicles and so on. So I think it would strengthen the bill if there's an explicit inclusion around the evidence of pain and torture. On the issue of the SADC protocol, I'm sorry, we don't know. And I'm not going to...
Ms. Swartz raised, I don't think, my understanding is that the issues with the absence of Article 3 relate more to the problems that we were experiencing, the trafficking bill, than to anything else, with those similar sections relating to Home Affairs.
Then the last question was on superior orders. We can consult the jurisprudence from the European Court and from the various tribunals and try and bring some light on this particular issue. But the fact of the matter is that the prohibition of torture is absolute, and there can be no excuse. So it's not a case of that one can be absolved from responsibility because the order to commit torture is a manifest unlawful one, and the bill says it as much. Thank you.
We didn't get that. Whether you would agree with it as a mitigatory factor?
As I said, we will gladly go and look at what the jurisprudence says about it and to what extent it has been considered as a mitigating factor and come back to the committee.
Suggestion of the Burdamach trial where the accused had been just recently been convicted. I think the accused alleged torture during their incarceration because I think it was like hip hop or rap or title music was being played to them.
They wanted sucky sucky. Yes.
Mr. Jeffries, I think one can talk about these things lightheartedly, but perhaps also one should bear in mind that the convention speaks of torture and other ill treatment. So acts do not necessarily amount to torture, but what we know from research and numerous reports from all over the world is that those places of detention where ill treatment is prevalent, that it very often leads to torture. And I can't give the committee clear advice on this, but it is perhaps something that should be taken into account. How does one deal with matters of ill treatment that do not amount to torture? And I'm thinking, for instance, the overcrowded prisons, the poor conditions of detention in police stations and various other facilities. Surely those people are also victims that require redress and certain standards need to be communicated clearly to the persons in charge of those facilities. Thank you.
I don't know if you'd know, but the torture at Abu Ghraib prison, I think were some Americans who were convicted of that. Do you know if they went to jail?
Not offhand, but we can
just please. All right, Schaefer.
How'd your proposal regarding obvious signs of torture help with regard to mental torture? I mean, some people might have a mental illness before they go into prison, then they come out and claim that they actually have been tortured and now they've got a mental illness. So how do you deal with that one?
The field of forensic investigations around torture is evolving. That is something where in South Africa we are really short on skills, and it presents an enormous difficulty in prosecutions and investigations and prosecutions. I think if people who claim to have suffered mental torture, one can probably get advice from psychologists, psychiatrists who would be able to make a proper diagnosis of whether there are symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder and any other symptoms. So I don't think it's impossible, but it is something that is not necessarily very easy to resolve.
Firstly, on a relative free question regarding whether George Bush should be arrested if he ever set foot in South Africa, and whether that was an international obligation lying under Republic, under either the Rome Statute or the Convention Against Torture. It is actually an obligation under the Convention Against Torture to arrest George Bush if he ever set foot in South Africa for acts of torture he instigated or did not punish adequately committed in Iraq. So it is an obligation under the convention, and Article 7 of the Convention Against Torture. Unfortunately, I don't have the convention in front of me. But,
why didn't you raise Tony Blair?
DNP was requested to raise Tony Blair.
No. And they didn't.
So
they left the onus and obligation on you.
I was in Cape Town. If I had been in Tilburg, maybe.
Sorry, on this point, I mean, the specific reference to, if you're reading Article 7, first the offence is in Article 4, which is the general ones, shall in the cases contemplated in Article 5. Are the cases in Article 5 are the boats and the ship, the national and the national. So I don't agree with you. And which countries, that may be your reading, but in which countries do this?
Well, a recent case that was decided about a month ago by the International Court of Justice in the Hubbury case, Hussein Hubbury, he was...
I'm talking about Rome Statute. I mean,
ruling. The ruling was based on the UN Convention Against Torture. So he's a Chadian dictator who allegedly ordered the commission of torture in Chad, and he fled to Senegal, and for about, I think that was in 2000, so for about over 10 years now, he's been living a very comfortable life in Dakar, and victims of torture committed by the Chadian authorities have been trying to bring Mr. Habre to justice, and Senegal has always been very reluctant to try him, and then Belgium intervened and said, well, we will investigate and we will be happy to try him, and they did conduct preliminary investigations for about 3 or 4 years, and then said, well, we're ready, and then they sent an extradition request to Senegal, and Senegal said, well, not really, and the African Union then intervened and said, well, we'd really like Mr. Habre to be tried for the acts committed, because if he indeed committed those acts, he should be tried. And the African Union said, well, then he should be tried on African soil. But nothing was materializing. And eventually the Belgium brought a case against Senegal before the International Court of Justice, which was decided last month, in which the International Court of Justice ordered Senegal to either try or extradite Mr. Habre for acts of torture committed. And that decision was based with the legal foundation was the UN Convention Against Torture. Since then, the African Union has committed to set up a special tribunal with African jurors, African judges, for him to be tried in Senegal. So that is a clear example of acts of torture that were committed in Chad by Chadians against a Chadian, and he will nevertheless be tried in Senegal. And I'm not so sure they're just the judges of
Senegal. I was wondering to know which countries. So you basically, from the example, it would be then Belgium does this. Who else that you know of?
No, so Senegal will not do it.
I'm looking about which countries in their law have this requirement.
So Senegal has it in the legislation now. Belgium definitely has it as well. Spain was an example you took.
Spain was, okay. The jurisdiction was founded on the fact that torture was committed against Spanish citizens in Chile. It wasn't the general torturing of Fenicians, torturing of Chileans. It was, yeah.
There are, I'm happy to submit more information to the committee if on that issue. We'd be happy to. Okay.
Well, I think
I trust that you'll find out, sorry, Chair, that where George W. is going next and ensure that the convention is implemented well enough.
Why? I agree with him. I honestly believe Tony Blair should have been arrested when he said for check. Yes. Well, now the courts have said we must, in terms of Zimbabwe. Don't know.
Another example was where the Malawian president refused entry to Omar al-Bashir.
That was a national criminal defense statute.
Yes, but
he had the warrant issue.
Yes.
So it wasn't just the scenario. It was the warrant that was issued by the
Well, it's one of the issues we took up with the court when I was there recently, where we said to the prosecuting office, it's a one-sided approach. You issue warrants for African leaders, but there are other people outside of Africa. We never see them. You refer them to the UN Security Council, and we know what happens after that. And they conceded. Professor John Duguid set out a range of cases where the prosecuting office should have issued warrants for arrest and didn't. Well, he doesn't give reasons. That's one of the problems. He's not required to provide reasons by someone else we know. Mr. Minton, thank you. It's been very interesting. All right. Where are we? Center for Applied Legal Studies.
Was part of the previous submission.
Oh.
Presumably you'll also motivate on minimum sentences and the
Thank you for the opportunity. Thank you. My name is Kathleen Hardy and I am an attorney at the Centre for Applied Legal Studies. Just before I start with my submissions, and I'm not planning on reading them verbatim, just stressing some of the more important points today. Just in answer to the question previously about the extradition protocol, static extradition, Article 4F of the protocol actually says that if there is a chance of torture, it's a mandatory ground for refusal for extradition under the protocol. And then also just in answer to also previous debate on which countries actually exercise this form of jurisdiction, mm-hmm. I just do want to mention that in terms of universal jurisdiction, states are actually obliged to arrest individual just on the basis of universal jurisdiction. So there does not have to be any link. And that's because the prohibition against torture is seen as an obligation erga omnes or us cogens, which is basically that the prohibition against torture enjoys a higher status in international law than any other. So just on the basis of universal jurisdiction alone. Okay, now on to our submissions. Basically, our submissions aim to address whether the bill fully complies with South Africa's obligations under the Convention and other international law obligations. We hope that our submissions will assist in establishing a legislative framework that is as comprehensive as possible to prohibit and prevent torture and to protect fundamental human rights. Just following on, there was previous discussion about the definition and whether it in fact falls short of what is required under the Convention. We are of the opinion that the definition as it currently stands falls short of what's required in the Convention because of the fact that it omits the torture committed at the instigation of or with the consent or acquiescence of a public official or other person acting in an official capacity. Even if you read Section 3 of the bill with Section 1, which is that third leg of the definition of the public official, we are of the opinion that it still falls short of that which is required. And the reason we submit this is because it fails to provide for the criminal liability of a public official who knew or should reasonably have known that torture was being committed or had been committed and in fact failed to do anything about it. So in this instance, and it's been explicitly mentioned in general comment number 2, that state parties need to adopt effective measures to prevent authorities from consenting to or acquiescing in any acts of torture. Failure to explicitly do so in law results in actually in a violation of the Convention. The importance of this is because also the Special Rapporteur has emphasized the fact that this provision extends the state's obligations into the private sphere. So it should be interpreted to include the state's failure to protect individuals from acts of torture. An example of this, if you'd like to see an example, there's explicit wording of an example of this provision in the, we refer to it in our submission, the UK Torture Damages Bill. Although it's a bill before the House of Lords, and it's in fact, in terms of civil damages or redress, that can actually be used as a guideline as to how we should specifically incorporate that. But like you said, we do endorse CSPRI submissions, and we agree with them that the definition of torture should explicitly include that wording to cover these instances. Then moving on to there is an omission of other acts of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment or punishment in the bill. Article 16 of the Convention provides that the state must undertake to prevent other acts of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment which do not amount to torture. The bill omits any reference to other ill treatments in its entirety. Our submission is that we should criminalize these other acts, and we need to, in fact, provide appropriate punishment as well. We also have the respectful submission and opinion that it's not too difficult to include the idea of what these acts are and what constitutes other ill treatment within the bill. Many foreign jurisdictions have, in fact, done so, and the Committee Against Torture provides guidelines in this regard as well. However, at a minimum, and as part of our obligation to prevent torture, we have to prevent other acts of ill treatment. General comment 2, the Committee Against Torture said that states need to prohibit, prevent, and redress torture and other acts of ill treatment in all contexts. So as an absolute minimum, we would like the bill to at least include some reference to other acts of ill treatment and what they mean. For instance, in Section 8 of the bill, in terms of training and educating officials and individuals at a minimum. The Robben Island Guidelines actually recognize, and I know they're not binding, but also just to guide this, they recognize that in order to combat impunity, states should actually ensure that those responsible for acts of torture, and again, they include all other ill treatment, are in fact subject to legal process. So it is our submission that we need to somehow incorporate these other acts in the bill. Under offences and penalties, this is just following on from what I'd say first about the definition of torture and the omission of the consent or the acquiescence of the public official. The bill is not clear regarding instances where torture is committed with the consent or acquiescence. We believe that it must be inserted in the bill in clear and unambiguous manner. If you look at the debate that's happened just between CSPRI and what I'm saying now and in the committee a bit earlier, it's clear that it's not certain, and it seems to be a bit ambiguous at the moment. But it must be clear that both the individual who perpetrated the torture, as well as the public official who knew or should reasonably have known of such torture, should both be prosecuted of the crime of torture. Then I just want to quickly just mention the fact that the absolute prohibition against torture, which recognises that there can be absolutely no ground of justification for torture committed under any circumstances. The Inter-American Convention to Prevent and Punish Torture goes a little bit further than the Torture Convention itself, and we just recommend that Section 4.4 of the bill be expanded somewhat to include also domestic disturbances and strife. If we had a look at what's happened at Marikana not so long ago, I think it's a good example as to why we need to possibly look to expand the grounds of Section 4.4 of the bill. Then I just want to briefly mention the factors to be considered in sentencing. I think that there should be a bit of clarification provided on those factors. While we appreciate the inclusion of aggravating factors to be considered during sentencing in the bill, we feel that these are somewhat ambiguous. There's no guidance provided on how exactly these need to be used when considering an appropriate sentence. So we think that some clarification will be needed in terms of the section. In particular, we reference that the Philippines law, for example, prescribes specific sentences where certain consequences result come about as a result of the torture. Importantly, it has been mentioned previously, but also we are of the opinion that the lawful presence of an individual in the Republic is not a requirement to exercise extraterritorial jurisdiction. Article 5.2 of the Convention explicitly states that the state party must take measures as are necessary to establish the jurisdiction where the alleged offender is present. For some reason, the bill adds the additional requirement of being lawfully present in the Republic. We submit that the lawfulness or otherwise of the presence of the person to be charged is irrelevant, and that word lawfully should be removed to bring it in line with the Convention, as well as our own other domestic legislation, like the implementation of the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court Act, which does not have the lawfulness of the individual within the country as a requirement. I'm not going to go into all the inclusion of measures for redress in the bill. It has been covered quite comprehensively, and I do refer to our written submissions in this regard. Just to say that some principles, redress in and of itself is huge. It's a very large field, and not all the principles that are required are in fact apparent from the bill in its current form. We will be happy to engage more with the committee on redress particularly, if need be. Also, on the provisions to promote the awareness and to prevent torture, CSPRI went through a few of them now. We're not going to repeat it. But again, are happy to engage with the committee on these further ones, and we refer to our written submissions. We agree with the duty to report and that there should be a provision in the bill regarding a state's duty to report, especially because South Africa is late with our reports, but also because of the broader benefit that this would provide if mechanisms are in place. Again, also on the principle of non-refoulement, we support also the LHR and CSPRI submissions in this regard, and that we think that although it is in a sense a recognized principle in our law, you could say through the case law there is precedent on this, that there should be an explicit mention in the bill of this. And also just to note that the Special Rapporteur has said that at times domestic assurances are in fact not sufficient because they're not legally binding and are often no more than attempts to circumvent the absolute prohibition of torture. So I think we should just keep in mind that sometimes, although it is a political issue, diplomatic assurances in and of themselves are not all sufficient.
just on the exclusion of evidence obtained as a result of torture. Yes, it is confirmed by Section 35(5) of our Constitution, but we think that there should be explicit inclusion of a provision in the bill to this effect, and that such evidence should not be limited to written statements obtained. Often evidence will come about from a written statement, like pointing out, etc., further evidence, so all evidence should be excluded. No one has yet discussed this, so I'm a little bit anxious to start this debate, but we submit that the bill should operate retrospectively.
How are you
going to
get us to court?
I'm a little bit nervous, but I'll do it anyways, right? So, Article 15 of the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights provides that, obviously, no person can be found guilty of a criminal offence which did not constitute such an offence under national or international law at the time it was committed. You may, however, prosecute a person for a crime that was a crime according to the general principles of law recognized by the community of nations. So Section 35(3)(l) of our Constitution, which encompasses the right to a fair trial, includes the right not to be convicted for an act or an omission that was not an offence under national or international law at the time it was committed. Section 232 of our Constitution further provides that customary international law in the Republic unless it is inconsistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. Torture is an international crime. The prohibition against torture is customary international law. The prohibition against torture is a exclusion or peremptory norm. So we submit that the bill should have an explicit retrospective application. That in and of itself is maybe a bit daring, but then also the question arises as to, okay, from when? Our submission or recommend a suggestion is that possibly from the date that we ratified the convention, being 10 December of 1998. That covers the fact that that is after the final constitution, so Section 232 was in force, making sure that customary international law is law in the Republic unless inconsistent with the Constitution or an Act of Parliament. So it covers that base, and it is in essence when South Africa made their open recognition to be bound entirely by the Convention and its contents. So we just need to be clear that you know, the principle of legality only extends where you're talking about the creation of a new offence or the creation of a new crime. That's not what this would be. We're not creating a new crime. Torture has always been a crime. In fact, if you go to any ordinary member of the public and during these deliberations and the work I've been doing around this and the work that Powers as an organisation does, and you speak to individuals, they are shocked that torture is not a crime. If we were to do a survey, I'm almost positive that the majority of South Africans actually believe every single day that torture is a crime, that you will be prosecuted, not for assault, for torture. So this isn't about the creation of a new offence, it's about the retrospective application of a crime that has always been in existence.
How far back?
1998, when we ratified the convention.
Why 1998?
Because that's when we ratified the convention, so I don't think you could come up with any difficulties. It was recognized in 1998 in the Foreign Desert judgment that torture is in fact an international crime under customary international law, so you're covered in that respect. And the Constitution was in place because Section 232 of the Constitution says customary international law is law in the Republic. So it was customary, so we're not only talking about international law crime. The Constitution made the prohibition against torture law in South Africa through Section 232 of the Constitution.
But you could also
argue that we have similar approaches to Constitution and effectively make it before it happens. And then just briefly, just on my last point before I know everybody is hungry and it's lunchtime. On the protection of vulnerable groups, just following on the Women's Legal Centre and the fact we feel that gender is a very important element to be reflected in the bill, gender and torture. Because women are recognised as a discrete
group whose experience of torture is similar to, but also quite different from men. The committee itself has recognized that gender is a key factor in the prevention and the prohibition of torture. And there's various contexts at which women are at risk of torture, and it extends from reproductive decisions, but particularly violence by private individuals in the home and communities. And this is another reason why I think we need to include the express wording of a definition of torture committed with the consent or acquiescence of the public official. Because this, it's a bit slightly, but it's possible. Because the failure of the state to exercise the diligence required to stop and intervene acts of torture and to sanction and provide remedies to the victims, in fact facilitates and enables non-state actors to continue to commit these acts with impunity and almost with the de facto permission of the state. So the Committee Against Torture has applied this principle, it has been applied, to the state's failure to prevent and to protect victims from gender-based violence. Domestic violence, rape, and other violent acts committed by private individuals may be seen as acts of torture or ill treatment. There is a lot in this field, and if you would like more information on this, I'd be happy to provide it. So we recommend that there is some recognition of this in the bill in reinforcing protection of vulnerable groups and women in particular. The specific protection that should be afforded to women in the prevention and the prohibition of torture has also been recognized by the Special Rapporteur. Many of the provisions of the, and just to say also that there's a lot of positive in the convention, I mean the bill as well, which we've also mentioned in our submissions, like non-custodial sentences, etc. However, there's also many provisions that we have to do at a minimum to be in compliance with the convention, but that does not mean we cannot extend beyond the minimum which is required. Apartheid ended, but the torture and the ill treatment seems to continue in our country with impunity. So can we take the opportunity maybe to at least to be a leader, particularly within Africa, I think, in the prevention and the combating of torture. And thank you very much for listening to me today.
Very, very good. Let me start off.
Okay.
Is there jurisprudence for retrospectivity?
I must be honest, I prepared, so international law is my specialized field, especially international criminal. I prepared the submissions and I was very gung-ho, and then I realized when I was doing the verbal ones that I actually have to come support that. There is not much. But there is some, yes. I don't have it with me at the moment, but I do have a researcher who's currently working on this. And if you would like, we'd be more than happy to send full substantiation of this to you. We will supplement, and we can do it within the next week or so.
Because my next question was, how are you going to get past the courts? Because the courts have told us it's the legislature. Retrospectivity? No.
But I mean, our own constitution, this is not the creation of a new offence. This has been an offence for many years under customary international law. What's the point of section 232 of our own constitution if we're not going to use it in some sense? Customary international law is law in the Republic, which means the prohibition and the prevention. The prohibition against torture has in fact been law in our country since the final constitution came into law, at a minimum. And the interim constitution contained a similar provision. The retrospective application, I think, is important. And I also think, you know, whether there's examples of this elsewhere or not, it's a very good example. We could be a leader in this. Uganda recently, not so recently, but a little bit back, implemented their own statute act. And there was a lot of talk about whether they were going to implement retrospectively, because war crimes, crimes against humanity, have been crimes for many, many, many years, as torture has. And they failed to do so. And that failure to do so has actually got them into a bit of trouble now on the ground in terms of implementation. And trying to actually prosecute those for the civil war, they have difficulty now because they did not have retrospective application. It's totally within the principle of legality to have retrospective application of the crime of torture here.
Ms. Schaefer?
understand that more. I mean, if it's already a crime in our country, then why has the NPA not prosecuted anyone for torture? And why do we keep on having to hear that it's not a crime? And why do we have to domesticate now? Yeah. Anyway, I mean, my question really is, so are you not supporting previous submission of which you were a part that calls for the overturning of the principle of innocence until proven guilty? Or are you still sticking to that? And the other thing is, I quite like this idea, that are you saying now, under your understanding, that police could be held liable for failing to go and investigate when people report domestic violence? Because I quite like that.
Sorry, just clarification on the second one. Could the police?
You said the police as public officials, when they refuse to go and investigate domestic violence, continue the ongoing domestic violence complaints, can they now be charged with torture, in your view?
Just
want to comment about application of the bill retrospectively. To say that in the manner in which you present it, it's actually interesting, but how it can be made applicable, I think that's what's contentious, something that needs to be looked into before we can even start thinking of what to do about it. Was already with some of the processes, there's been pardons, there's been amnesty, and how do you deal with that, let alone the fact that the courts have already indicated that we can't go retrospective. But I like the idea that you want to bring in the gender perspective in this, which will actually, to a large extent, help deal with matters of gender-based violence, which are problematic in the country. No, we do have the Domestic Violence Act, but there still continues to be problems regardless of the fact that we have a piece of legislation. Maybe if we deal with it differently from this perspective, it might actually have some kind of effect. And maybe to say that when it comes to additional information, we're getting additional information in terms of looking at matters retrospectively. And then earlier, we've requested, is it CSR? Yes. CSI. We've actually requested them to give us more information when it comes to arrest of foreign nationals. But also, what I want to add on to the request is that look at it also in context of diplomatic immunity.
Okay. Anybody else? No. And you're in favor of minimum sentences? Fair now.
Thank you, Lucas. It is. We are of the opinion on the commitment. It's tricky, right? It's tricky. But okay, let me start off by saying that we are very happy to see that there's only custodial sentences in the bill, and that's in accordance with it. And at the end of the day, the Committee Against Torture has provided guidance that when death results from a torture committed, life imprisonment should be imposed. We already have that in terms of the Minimum Sentencing Act. So it would already be applicable because death would ensue through the torture. In terms of, it's just that the gravity and the seriousness of the offence needs to be accounted for. At the moment, we have a situation where cases of mass torture and allegations of mass torture are just completely ignored. In their entirety, there's no recourse. There's no recourse. The individuals, and I know of these cases firsthand, had to go through so many hurdles. There's no medical examination. There's just no recourse whatsoever. And people committed with absolute impunity. South Africa was found guilty by the United Nations Human Rights Committee for St. Alban's torture that occurred in 2005. And we haven't even responded appropriately to the findings and the view of the United Nations Human Rights Committee. So, you know, it's a difficult, minimum sentencing in and of itself is difficult, but at the very least, yes, our submissions say that there are instances where minimum sentencing should be imposed, where appropriate, yes. In terms of the police, and I think I'm just going to put the question about the police and the domestic violence
and I'm going to link it to what was said about the gender, and we will definitely provide the committee with further information on the retrospective application with comprehensive submissions on that, and we will also provide further information on the gender elements. The director of health, Benita Meyersfeld, has written extensively on topic, and I will ask her to provide further guidance on that. But with the police being charged, yes, the police should be charged with maybe ill treatment, but yes, they should. And I've seen this in practice. I've seen it happen in practice. The Domestic Violence Act does not work. So women get a protection order. It does not work. She's at the police station every second day asking for protection. The protection order that she has against her abuser is of no force and effect, and I know of two instances where the police just didn't get there on time and the woman was murdered as a result. So yes, in instances like that, most definitely, if the police knew at least other cruel, inhumane and degrading treatment, yes. Yes, and in serious instances, torture, yes. Because it is happening with the consent and with the acquiescence of the police officials. Their job and their duty is to protect, and maybe this is an opportunity to try and fill some of the loopholes that we find in our domestic violence law currently. So on the gender perspective, we'll bring more information, and also on the retrospective application. Thank you.
Ooh. Lovely. We're done.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Ms. Hardy. On something else? All right.
Just to remind us, given out copies of the draft B version of
tomorrow.
Protection of Personal Information book. Just to say that the issue of, and you may have seen some of the emails.
There's a flood.
Clause 7 and Clause 72. There are probably likely to be. Clause 7 is the issue of the non-coded journalists. Clause 72 is the cross-border flows. Mr. Dupriya told me he would be sending a redraft on those sections at lunchtime, so hopefully by the afternoon we would have it.
Well, that's what he's saying, Dean. All right, honourable members, ladies and gentlemen, 2 o'clock, please. 2 o'clock, back here.